Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Father Stephen Privet, President of the University of San Francisco, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and moderator for tonight's event. We welcome our listeners on the radio, television, and internet, and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Kevin Starr, California State Librarian Emeritus, Professor of History at the University of Southern California, and author of Golden Dreams, California in an Age of Abundance, 1950 to 1963. Kevin Starr is a fourth-generation San Franciscan, an alumnus, former professor, and honorary degree recipient from his undergraduate alma mater, the University of San Francisco. Kevin served for 10 years as California State Librarian, and upon his retirement in 2004, was named California State Librarian Emeritus. He is unquestionably the preeminent expert on California history. He is the author of an 8-volume series on the history of the Golden State called America and the California Dream. His numerous publications have earned him, among other awards, a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Gold Medal of the Commonwealth Club, and in 2006, the National Humanities Medal from President George Bush at the White House. Dr. Starr's most recent book in his California Dream series is Golden Dreams, California in an Age of Abundance. This concluding volume completes a magnificent gift to us and future generations. It is the focus of this evening's presentation. As one reviewer noted, no other state possesses so intelligent, humane, and comprehensive account of its origins and development. Kevin Starr has written a story filled with heroic examples and tragic caution. Most of all, it is a series of histories that, like any life worth dreaming of, is worthwhile from beginning to end. It is my pleasure now to turn the microphone over to Dr. Kevin Starr.
Well, thank you very much, Father Privet, for such a marvelous introduction. And it's really a thrill to be here at with the Commonwealth Club, such a distinguished organization, and to be in such a beautiful city as Lafayette, and also to be, I myself am a veteran, to be in one of the most, the most beautiful veteran centers I've ever been in. It's just absolutely exquisite structure, and may it serve to be a point of pleasure for veterans in many, many years to come. We owe veterans so much in our society, and this place expresses, I think, that gratitude felt by the society. Well, this book was a long time founding, so is California. When I finished my Army service and I received a scholarship to Harvard from the Ralston Purina Chow Company, a Danforth Fellowship, and that's why I encouraged my two daughters when they were growing up to eat a lot of wheat Chex and rice Chex, and because it was a wonderful scholarship because it paid the tuition, gave me living expenses, and so I was able to move through my PhD with the GI Bill and with the Danforth Fellowship and with a teaching fellowship at Harvard in rather rapid order. In fact, I took a pay cut when I finished being a graduate student and had to actually go to work. But, you know, you make a decision. I was in the American Literature program at Harvard with an emphasis on the history of American civilization. You make a decision about what graduate thesis you're going to write, your PhD thesis. It can bog you down. It can destroy you. Or it can be an open door to a great future a lifetime of research and a very satisfying subject. I had no idea initially that I would take this series through an 8-volume sequence. The first book I did was The Americans in the California Dream, 1850 to 1915. And I love doing that. I loved in dialoguing with the Grand Victorians, Henry George and Josiah Royce and Isadora Duncan and Gertrude Atherton and the Stanfords and the Big Four and the Silver Kings. That history is familiar to most of us. I mean, it's really part of our living heritage. But when I began to read at Harvard, on the fourth floor of Widener Library, I began to browse and to select books. Harvard, now you're going to hear a librarian talk for a moment. Harvard feels exempt when it chooses to from the Dewey Decimal System or the Library of Congress system. So consequently, its collection, California, was California. And that made it very simple to find it on the fourth floor. But I could never figure out it was right next to the collection Dante, what the two had in common, except for perhaps that California had a heaven, hell, and purgatory dimension to it, as also in the Divine Comedy. But I had always admired the narrative historians of the 19th century, and to say this is not to put myself in their league, far from it. I admired Prescott's History of the Conquest of Mexico. I love Francis Parkman's chronicling the great epic of France in the New World in Canada, and Motley's Rise of the Dutch Republic. These Americans who in the 19th century, in the midst of doing everything else they were doing, also wrote superb narrative history. And later, I loved the work of Van Wyck Brooks, his Makers and Finders series. Van Wyck Brooks, who passed on about 30 years ago, and that kind of long narrative sweep that he gives, beautiful writing in his books. I was very interested in that. But more importantly, in Van Wyck Brooks, I was very interested also in the effort to connect the intersection of personal experience, social experience, opportunity, and necessity in the creation of a commonwealth. And I'll use that word commonwealth with the state of California. Not the Commonwealth of California, but we are a commonwealth. I mean, an extraordinary entity was created. It was created in 1849 when we established the Constitutional Convention. It was refounded in 1879 when we drafted the Second Constitutional Convention. It was refounded in the 1911 to 17 period during the Progressive Era when we reformed the state politically and established the political infrastructure that we live in to this day. And it was changed radically, too, with great population booms, the boom of the gold rush to bring over 300,000 Americans over a period of time into California. In fact, that precipitated our development, bypassing territorial status and going right to statehood. And it grew again with the population movement into the Southern California when the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe arrived between 1884 and 1888. Incidentally, I have to be very careful because when I say Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe, I want to sing it out like Judy Garland sang it out. And I know I can't do that at the Commonwealth Club, but it's a marvelous... That's the only railroad I know whose name is a great poem, it's just in and of itself. And it grew in the 1900 to 1930 period, when over 3.2 million people came into Southern California. Los Angeles made the transition from a city of 100,000 to a city of well over a million. And, of course, today Los Angeles population is well into the 3.45. I'll have to go check the latest statistics on that. So when you're inventing something like this, when something is happening like this, a lot of things are important to look at. You have to look at the economy, social structure, politics. But you often, I think, have to look at what California promised. Now, because I did my graduate studies at Harvard, where I was one of 12 San Ignatius High School and University of San Francisco graduates to be there, and we all used to get together for a yard of ale at the Yard of Ale occasionally, my professors there had an enormous respect for the various regions. And saw the American, although they had a kind of bias for New England, but that's okay. All Yankees have a bias. All New Englanders have a bias for New England. But they also projected out into the great mid-Atlantic states with the tradition of the Enlightenment and to the American South and to the Midwest, etc. In other words, I absorbed a sense of California history as American history. And we still have a little battle to go on that. We, California and Texas, I think, still have a battle to establish each of its histories as representative of the national experience. In fact, the more California continues on, and as we look to 2040, when we're going to be 50 million to 55 million Californians, and I don't want you to shudder, I'm only using some statistics that are put out there. By the end of this 21st century, we might have a third the population of the United States. I can hear the shuddering already. We become increasingly representative. We were not a creation of the North or the South. We were a compromise between the North and the South. We were not a creation of any one particular religious group. We were a mosaic of religious identities. Now, I'm not trying to say that everybody loved everyone in California as they came in. But no group drove any other group out. And whatever the suffering was, and I make one exception here, the Native Americans were especially vulnerable. They were vulnerable to disease. They were vulnerable to the California militia after them and their population. By the time Ishii came out of the forest up in Oroville in August 1911, there might have been as few as 40,000, maybe even fewer than that, Native Americans left. And, of course, today that population has recovered. We have more Native Americans now in the state than we had before the Spanish arrived. So I'm not exculpating what happened, but I'm saying thank God there was not a full a genocidal extermination of the Native American peoples. But you don't pull together a society like that without having the representative figures, human figures, extremely important. And you don't pull a society together without communicating to people a lesson that ordinary Americans, middle Americans, working Americans can have a better life, can indeed have the American dream in its California dimension. Now, the first volume I did was 1850-1910. Then I did The Rise of Southern California from the teens and the 20s. Inventing the Dream. Then I did Material Dreams, The Rise of Los Angeles in the 20s. Then I did Endangered Dreams, The Depression. And then I did The Dream Endures of the expatriates, all the great expatriates that came here fleeing Nazi Germany from German, usually German-speaking, but also French-speaking cultures, and absolutely transformed our culture in California. And then the last one, in Battle Dreams about World War II, this one from 50 to 63. Now, I don't want to go on with the next book, or at least I have no plans right now to go on the next book from the mid-60s through the 70s. But I do have the title for the historian who wants, if any historian here wants to take it on for that. You can call it Smoking the Dream, California in the 70s. But I basically understood the 50s and the early 60s. But I spent the 60s in the Army or at graduate school. I didn't tune out or drop in or whatever you're supposed to do. So I really, I could take the Beach Boys. I do the Beach Boys here up to 63. But a lot of the things that happened after that, just I couldn't figure them out. They were not anything, with all due respect, I learned about it at the University of San Francisco. None of us did, because there's an explosion that happened in our culture, didn't there, 64, 65. In fact, you take a look at yearbooks for 1961, 62, whether high school or college yearbooks, and you see students, and they've got the narrow ties, and the women have ponytails, and they're dressed for in a kind of that Talbot mode. And you take then you say, well, let's see what 1966, 67 looks like. And let me tell you, they do not look that way. And that transformation is very rapid, a year or two, a very rapid time. And one of the things that you learn, incidentally, about being a college professor is how rapidly student generations shift and change. Student generations can change, I think, very rapidly, 3-4 years, 5 years, maybe even less than that. And you feel a whole different range of attitudes. But this volume intrigued me because it took me from the time I was 10 to the time I was 23. By the time this volume is finished, I'm serving as a tank lieutenant in a tank battalion in Germany. It was also the time in which Californians absorbed an enormous amount of people, but rising to 17 million people very rapidly after World War II from approximately 9 million, and laid down the global infrastructure, laid down the infrastructure of a global state in which we live today. Just as the Progressive Era set up our political culture, the freeways, the California water plants system, the development of these great suburbs, the rise of our state, the expansion of our state park system, which actually goes back to much earlier in the 20th century, all that was very largely East Bay driven. Incidentally, East Bay has always had a very strong conservationist position, either with the Sierra Club or Warren Olney or the campers, I forget what they're called, the Merry campers, et cetera, that became activists. It's a wonderful history. But this infrastructure was laid down, and it's really the infrastructure that we're in now. And as a bureaucrat, bureaucrat's a good word. I love being a bureaucrat. I served 15 years as a bureaucrat, 5 years as a, actually 18 years as a bureaucrat. 5 years as librarian of San Francisco, 10 years as librarian of the state of California, and 3 years as Alston Burr senior tutor in Elliott House. So bureaucrat's not a bad job for me. I think, in fact, if I add the year I was a tank executive officer, I could add another half year on that. And I think bureaucracy is important. It's important to administer things. And that's why I paid attention in this book to the great plans where our elected officials challenged the civil service and said, come up with a plan. And the civil service came up with the freeway plan of 1957. Then it's up to the elected officials representing the people to say what components of that will be funded and constructed. And I love reading those plans. I know that's a rather strange obsession to confess to. And I love their dazzling titles. For instance, our whole water plan, the largest single water construction program in the history – my wife cautions me about this, of the world, but I'll say one of. The state water plan was implemented through three publications, Water Bulletin Number 1, Water Bulletin Number 2, and Water Bulletin Number 3. Those are snappy titles. And then, of course, the Master Plan for Higher Education, which was assembled under the chairmanship of Dr. Arthur Koontz, the president of Occidental, and pushed through politically by Dorothy Donohoe, one of the great, there should be a statue to her in Sacramento for that program, which envisioned California as a higher educational utopia resting on four legs, the pillars, the University of California, the California State University, the community college system, and the private sector. The fourth system being the private sector, all of them working together to create a higher educational utopia in this state, which, of course, has profoundly affected us over the last 50 and more years. So how do I get at these topics? Well, it's very interesting. They say about Larrabout French bread that it's a yeast the yeast that makes sourdough is alive. So the Larrabout French bread yeast is supposed to be alive since 1849. Well, I have a California bibliography that's been alive since 1964. I started at Harvard, and we've schlepped it to here and there, et cetera. At one point, it was an astonishing circumstance. This is before the computer, where you can store these things now much more economically. And I had all this material, and I don't organize too quickly. One of my heroes also as a writer is Edmund Wilson, whose chapters each stand for them, relate to each other, but can be read independently. So I always, all my books, I've tried to do that. You can start a book in the middle and go back or forth, but they read better if you move forward. But each of the chapters is somewhat self-contained. I threw myself into this period, and I found that I was also recovering myself, because this was the California that formed me as a boy of 10 to a young man of 23. Now, nonfiction. Last year, I had the privilege of being a National Book Award judge for nonfiction. It's a golden age of nonfiction. I'm sure if you go to your bookstore, not that I'm knocking the novel. I love the novel, especially love the great Russian and American novel of Henry James and Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. And I love the American novelists like Marquand and John O'Hara and John Updike, novelists that explore what American life is like. But the novel is flourishing. It's better than ever. But fiction has always been accepted as a mode for imaginative discourse, where nonfiction now has become a really form of important writing. Look at David McCulloch's John Adams. I don't know where you can encounter better writing, at least in my opinion, better writing than that. A more capacious view, a more dramatic example of intellect and imagination going back in through memory and historical research and recreating the past. But as National Book Award judge, we had a superb amount. We reviewed over 350 books, selected five very wonderful finalists, and I was convinced the amount of writing, good writing in nonfiction, is there. This is somewhat long-winded way of expressing the fact that when you write nonfiction, you're writing also to your imaginative life, but you're projecting it out and disciplining it through the story you tell. And in this case, I was telling the story of the forces that shaped me during this critical time, and I was also talking about the state that I was privileged to serve for 15 years as a library, the city and state that I was privileged to serve for 15 years as a library administrator. Well, I began with San Fernando on the rise of suburbs, and I think you'll enjoy that, being as you are in one of the great successful suburbs of the state. For Southern California suburbs, I emphasize the fact that most of the successful suburbs down there were not just dormitory suburbs put on the landscape, as is sometimes charged. Most of them grew out of existing townships and cities. Many of them had, like, for instance, San Bernardino coming from the 1850s, or Orange from the 1880s, or Pomona from the 1880s. So you had these earlier identities that were coherent, so the effort became to graft these new suburbs onto that older identity, that older political system, and it's absolutely fascinating. And I have a lot of fun looking, for instance, at different sources. Like, I track the number of swimming pools in the San Fernando Valley. I think it reaches a height of about 600 permits given by 1960, et cetera. Well, that's a very interesting phenomenon. Or what ordinary people could afford. It's important to know that, of course, that a Hollywood producer can have a marvelous life, but it's also important to know what, by 1954, 55, a factory worker, a production machinist, married with two children, how he could live, what he could afford. And so I go into that. I go into the whole sovereignty of home ownership and how home ownership extends our personal sovereignty, the importance of home as a concept in the evolution of American culture. Then in the second chapter, I go into the designs that were used, modernism designs. One of the great thrills I had was the Eichler homes. I thought the Eichler homes were just spectacular. They were efficient. They were built in a way for a mass society. You put all the electrical things in one column that came up through the center of the house. You poured a concrete floor. The roof roof rose up on the house like a Japanese painting. It seemed to be suspended over an invisible wall, which was actually glass and steel. It was marvelous. I like Joseph Eichler's social philosophy, too, that he didn't want to discriminate against anybody. If you can afford the house, you're an upstanding citizen, you come there. It's like Nat King Cole, when he moved into Hancock Park, there was a circular given around the whole Hancock Park saying, would you please be alert to the neighborhood group, alert to any undesirables moving in? And Nat King Cole wrote back saying, oh, I'll be very alert. I don't want any undesirables moving in here to Hancock Park. After all, this is Hancock Park. So I look at those, and I look at the modern design, but I also think I deserve credit for taking tiki seriously. Tiki, whether in Southern California it's Don the Beachcomber or whether up here it's Trader Vic's. Why do we Californians love tiki so much? What was this post-war, or actually late 1930s, 40s, and 50s obsession with tiki? Well, I go into the relationship of South Pacific. I try and give it some justification, James Mitchell stories, et cetera. But tiki as a demographic style and tiki as a festival style, welcoming Americans who could now afford to go out to dinner. In the 1930s and during the World War II period, people couldn't afford to go out to dinner. For a family to go out to dinner, ordinary working people, middle-class people, that was a big thing. Just like these suburban homes afforded them an opportunity to have each of their children, or at least two children, in a bedroom, where you look at the statistics in the 1930s, you might have three or four children in a bedroom. And an uncle who was a merchant marine occasionally coming in and sacking out on the couch in the front room for 6 weeks at a time. It was a different relationship to space. Then I look at the creation of the University of California expansion, the effect of the Cold War research, an extraordinary impact of brain power coming out of the Cold War. And the Cold War dominates. It's the theme all through here. I remember as a boy having to duck under the desk when the sister would have you do a drill, etc. And we all live with that. People of a certain age live with the apocalyptic. I mean, we understood the movie Dr. Strangelove before it was half over. We've been lived that way all our life, etc. Today, it looks so horrendous. Well, it did have effects on our psyche, both bad and good. It made coolness, for instance. Coolness. Why is California cool such a good thing? I think partly Cold War. I look at jazz, the way jazz cooled down, the jazz tradition in California. I do a whole chapter on my own generation, the silent generation. We're the only generation, these are people born more or less 36 to 46, we're the only generation in the history of this nation not to produce a president. But we did produce Jerry Brown and Dick Cheney, so we're not without contribution to the nation. But we did produce an enormous number. We produced Senator Feinstein, Judge Breyer, all kinds of wonderful people in politics and acting. Natalie Wood, born here in the Bay Area in 1940. And I look at these various, Robert Haas, our great poet laureate, and I look at the various people of that generation, because it's a very small generation. The World War II generation was great and grand and the greatest. And the boomers were thinking themselves the greatest. So you have a little small generation caught between the two, and it gave a certain tension to and I wanted to go out, I wanted to dispel some of the myths that you had that the 50s was everybody was running around being oppressed and depressed. It wasn't the case. For instance, I went through hundreds and hundreds of yearbooks. And I looked, yearbooks are a very interesting source for historical analysis. First of all, it's just impressionistic, but they're at once a folkloric genre. Every yearbook's the same, and yet every yearbook is different, and yet also every yearbook is to a certain extent under the control of the high school students producing it. So when I went back to the 50s and saw all sorts of minority students, not a whole overwhelming number, but a number of them in schools that were largely white elected to student body president, when I saw women assuming major members of the Engineers Club as well as the Future Mothers of America's Club, etc., when I saw the effort of the state of California on all levels to keep as much as possible the comprehensive high school together, so that students who were becoming mechanics for United Airlines and students who were becoming business people and students who were going to become nuclear physicists would all at least have something in common, a common culture. We'd all read Romeo and Juliet when we were freshmen, and we would read Merchant of Venice was our junior year. If you really were smart, you could read Hamlet in your senior year. But there was something like a curriculum. It wasn't tight, totally comprehensive. So I looked at that particular, those elements of control that were exercised. I also, these are all feeding into the mood, the creation of the infrastructure, the education of the future generation, the creation of great urban cities, and the effectiveness of politics. Something happened in 1958 when Governor, correction, Senator Nolan and De Mortuis non dicendum nisi bonum. Did I say that correctly, Father? What was wrong? What case was wrong? Oh, I had the wrong word order. Okay. It's like being back in high school. Anyway, concerning the dead, only good should be said. So I don't want to say anything, but when Senator Nolan came in and told Governor Goodwin Knight that he couldn't run for a second term on his own, it was a big change. Because Governor Knight was a Republican through and through. We had a strong labor constituency. He was governed from the center. We had an institution. It was a work of genius called cross-filing, where Republicans could enter Democratic primaries and Democrats could enter Republican primaries. And that tended to make everybody gravitate towards the center. Republicans were down 1 million registered voters during this period, but they won most of the elections because they moved to the center and they got a significant percentage of Democratic votes. Richard Nixon almost won the Democratic nomination the second time he went back to Congress. So you had that old Progressive Party of California, that centrist dynamic, was was operative during this period. Governor Earl Warren, for instance, in 1946, would have had to run against himself. The cliche is that Earl Warren was this hang-'em-high conservative DA, and then he became governor, and then he went back to Washington, suddenly had a metanoia like St. Paul on the road to Damascus and became a liberal. No, Governor Warren had strong liberal and strong conservative streaks in him, as anybody would in this particular culture. His chief of staff, William Swigert, was a devout Catholic devoted to the social teachings of the papal encyclicals and was an ultra-liberal, but they got along very well. It was Governor Warren that signed the legislation ending the miscegenation laws, etc. So you had a continuity of politics from Governor Warren, a Democrat, to Governor Knight, a Republican, Governor Knight, a Republican, Pat Brown, a Democrat, and Ronald Reagan, a Republican. Sometimes, retrospectively, some historians like to make Ronald Reagan a poster boy for a revanche reactionarism. He had a Democratic majority in both houses. He got along with that. He knew what he could do and what he couldn't do. The Democrats did not disappear. You had a balance of power there. In fact, Governor Reagan signed one of the largest tax hikes we've ever had. The same way that Richard Nixon, when he became president, many historians today see him as the last New Deal president. Although the Watergate difficulties tend to give him another reputation. But this is the president gave us the Endangered Species Act, the HMO Act, the Model Cities Program, that appointed Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who went to China and opened up China, etc. So you can see that how that debate went on. Well, we lost that culture. That culture begins to fall apart, 59, 60, 61, 62. You can see the division of California begins to occur. Republican Party changes, Democratic Party changes, and become each of them progressively under the control of smaller groups of elites within those parties. And the great California voter who instinctively was in the center fades from the primary scene. Doesn't fade from the general election, but fades from the primary scene. Now, I try and do this in a bipartisan way. Believe me, if you're the state librarian who was appointed by, and I'm a Democrat, a Harry Truman Democrat, if I'm appointed by a Republican governor, Pete Wilson, and reappointed by a Democratic governor, Gray Davis, and then reappointed by a Republican governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, that testifies to the flexibility of my politics. I'm like the Vicar of Bray. I wanted to stay in my position. So I deal with that, and then I move towards various social programs after that period and the changes they occur. And in the last sequence, I look at times that are changing. And one of the things that you have to do is to say that all this growth had its price. How do you do this as a historian? You can't say it yourself. If you're going to do it, it might be a polemic. So I went back and read all the people who are cautioning us and saying there's too much growth. The environment is being hurt. Then there's an enormous, which I document, enormous literature of dissent that we're building too much water. If the city of Honda, if the Department of Water at the state, the subdivides, has a water plan for the city of Honda that will give 180,000 people water, and there's only about 12,000 people living in Honda, well, the water is actually the baseball field. If we build it, they'll come. And if you put freeways out, there was a big, lively debate. And incidentally, I don't want you to think these were all just crazed bomb throwers. Cap Weinberger was one of the leading people in this conservationist movement gathered around the publication Cry California. Cap Weinberger, very prominent Republican assemblyman, and later, of course, Secretary of Defense and the Director of the Division of Finance under Reagan, Secretary of Defense under Reagan. So they have a chapter of dissent in this last sequence. I also have a chapter on the beginning of the end of Jim Crow, California. Now, if I was to title it again, I would say the beginning of the beginning of the beginning, because it's not about civil rights movement. That's going to be pushed up a little further. But by 1965, you have a different environment. Just 2 years after the end of this book leaves, you have the Civil Rights Act, you have the defense of the reformation of our immigration law. And I chronicle during this period the increasing ability of the minorities communities to use the courts to redress it, that it's not legal to send Mexican children to separate schools on the basis of their skin color. They win the case. It's not legal to refuse to allow a marriage license to a Mexican American woman because her fiance is African American, and they win the case. It's not legal to keep property misappropriated during the internment of the Japanese and keep it after the war, and to continue to keep that property in public venue. They won the case. You can see these cases coming, where you have a very sophisticated opening up, making more flexible the particular society in which minority Californians have to work in, and in which I can't claim the great civil rights movement. That comes at a later time. But you do have the beginnings of the end, as I say, of Jim Crow. And then finally, the conflicts. I once asked Governor Pat Brown Sr. Well, Jerry is a different name. So Governor Pat Brown, I said, Governor, when did you think things changed? He said, the Chessman case. The Chessman case, I knew I was in a different zone, a different realm. I'm paraphrasing him, but all my charm, all my political ability, there was something intractable in that whole case. So that's when Chessman was executed in May 1960. So I end the book with that. I end the book with things like the anti-ROTC demonstrations at UC Berkeley. I end the book with the House Un-American Activities police riot against students in May of 1960. Things that foreshadow what's coming up in the next volume, which will be written most likely by someone who's now in the eighth grade. So for the time being, I'm going to go off and to do a few other books if I have the time for this. I certainly have the contracts, and the publishers are saying, when's the book due? When's it going to be doing? But it's been a great thrill to do these eight volumes, and to express my sense as a fourth-generation Californian, my sense of identification with the state through doing these histories, while at the same time working as a bureaucrat, as a college professor, as a public relations consultant, etc. I've always been very proud and wanting to be in the world of work. I like being I find that I use my time better if I'm alongside other people who are actually don't sit around all day staring at their navel. I have to get out and get with the program. A lot of people compliment me on the range of my research, et cetera. That's because I go to the job at 8, and I take a brief break at noon if I have the day free for write, and I continue the research to 5 or 6, and over a period of time that accumulates. And what has accumulated is my story of California. It's not the complete story. It's filled with very arguable points, but I've done my best to set out and to fulfill that question I asked myself as I wandered the stacks of the fourth floor of Widener Library in 1966, is there a story to be told about California that has not yet been told? Well, I tried to tell one, and there are probably many, many, many stories to be told that will continue to be told as the years go on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kevin Starr. Now we have time for some questions. The first question, which was asked by 5 people, centers on the need for the practicality of a constitutional convention for the state of California.
Well, I understand this. I understand impetus for that, because we're all dismayed by the dysfunctionalism of our sacramental culture, a statewide culture. I mean, how can a state which is the eighth largest economy on the planet with a 1.1 Oh, my goodness, I knew that a couple of days ago. I think 1.42 trillion GMP, how can it not be able to pay? How does it have to close down 100 state parks? That's not because Governor Schwarzenegger doesn't wake up in the morning saying, I'm going to close those parks. He doesn't say that. The system has broken down. We've lost our ability to agree on the public sector. You know, those before term limits, there were good old boys and good old girls up in Sacramento, and a few kind of slick college guys like Cap Weinberger and John Busterud, et cetera. And they went over to the hotel center and sometimes drank some maybe a little too much Maker's Mark, and they would all get together down at Frank Fats and have Chinese food, and they'd work it out. They'd work it out. I had dinner last night with Governor Pete Wilson, and he talked about that culture. When he first went as a young freshman Republican assemblyman to Sacramento, and all the friends he had as Republicans and how they hung out, et cetera. And they would cut a deal. They would not say to anybody, you can't have anything that you want. Well, then you alienate that person. If you have a requirement for a two-thirds majority, then politics break down. I think there's a line of continuity from Aristotle to Otto von Bismarck that says politics is the art of the possible. Politics is we get together, what's possible? We all have utopian ideals. We all can envision what we want. But that might involve imposing our will on others. And for during this period, the politicians got together and put together. I didn't make up the state water plan. I didn't make up that we did the California Higher Education Act. I didn't make up the dramatic expansion of the state park program. All right, but you have to have a coherent, to get to your question, you have to have a coherent culture. It is the fault. What's a quote, another quote that you can correct me on? Horatio, Hamilton Horatio, the fault, dear Horatio, is not.
Dear Brutus is not in, no.
No, dear Hamilton.
Yeah, you're right.
Is not, dear Horatio, is not in the stars, but in ourselves.
That we are underlings.
Exactly. And the Constitutional Convention says that we can do administrative tinkering and something will change. A Constitutional Convention doesn't say that we Californians, liberal, centrist, and conservative, agree that we negotiate the public sector with each other through our elected officials and come to agreements. Some agreements in which we don't get everything, but we certainly don't get nothing. That's a double negative, I think. But anyway, you get the point. That's Sacramento talk. So a state convention, if we had that now, I wonder who would be the what is the constituency? If that same fractionated point of view went to the convention, it would absolutely not make it. Now, you could say, well, we had a convention provoked by the International Working Men's Party, and you couldn't be any further left than that group in 1878-79, and it drafted a convention. Yes. But it also had 16 Republicans there. It had Democrats there. It had Grange people there. It had populist parties there. And it failed on the thing that it was actually trying to do, was to have land use reform in California. It wrote a constitution, which we operate in today, that is, if I'm correct in saying this, I think I am, the longest constitution second to India's only. India, this vast subcontinent with all its traditions and languages and religious needs a big constitution. Well, I wonder what. I wonder what a state convention would be if it were truly, if we had the same dysfunctional politics. It'd be like the food fight in Animal House. So all that's the answer to say I'm highly suspicious. I think that another scenario is that we're going to go through a near-death experience on the statewide level. Closing down 100 state parks is getting close to that. The things that are closed down that we ordinary apolitical centrist people are very shocked by. I don't think if a constitutional convention is dominated by the left, the right will resist it. It won't get elected through. If it's dominated by the right, the left will resist it. I think we have to restore a politics of left-right meeting at the center, negotiating, going down to Frank Fats, getting some Chinese food, and cutting a deal. That's what we send politicians up there to do.
Building off of that. As a historian, you look at the past, you look through the past at the present. Are you optimistic, or do you think California's golden age is over?
Oh, no. I've been always asked, what's my favorite period? Right now is my favorite period. Right, first of all, on a somewhat narcissistic way, because I'm still here, so I can enjoy it. And secondly, If you look at women's rights, minority rights, if you look at the empowerment and the broadening sympathies that most of us Californians have, it's a much superior world. Look at the medical. I'm a member of Kaiser Permanente for 30 years, and I'm a walking testimony to my doctors. Walking. My doctor's going to be studied at the Harvard Medical School. Look at the wonderful things that we... No, I think that... we did have levels of personalized culture in the past that were very impressive. I mean, Josiah Royce, his love of philosophy, and Isadora Duncan as a young woman of 16, reviving the dance of ancient Greece, but those things are still going on. The private sector... When we talk about state government dysfunctionism, we're not talking about private sector dysfunctionism. We're not talking about Californians not planting gardens. They're planting gardens, writing poetry. This is an epicenter of poetry. Dana Joya, one of our finest American poets from Los Angeles, and he's now living in Santa Rosa. The architecture, the physical fabric. As state librarian, I had the pleasure for 10 years dedicating new libraries. I had a $500 million construction fund, which you can you imagine the days you voters gave us that up in Sacramento. And we spent it correctly. Didn't have one project come back to bite us you know where. And you go to the different places and see how people love their communities, adorn their communities, are zealous for their communities. I think what we have to do is cure our statewide. You know, if we were put on the East Coast... Well, let's put it another way. If the Pilgrim fathers and mothers had landed in Santa Monica Bay rather than Massachusetts Bay, we'd have about 13 states out here. So we really don't ask New Jersey to totally get along with Delaware. They can get along, and they didn't during the Revolutionary War when they go. But we don't ask South Carolina to get along with Maine. But these are the areas where we encompass. And our founding generation in California carved this out. They thought it was a small alternative. Other than that, Mexican California included Nevada, Utah, Arizona, and southern parts of Colorado. So I think if you look at the vitality of our private sector, if you look at health statistics, et cetera, it doesn't mean we don't have a lot of work to do. We do. But in the private sector, that will buoy up and create the desire, in my opinion, why I'm optimistic, to say we need to reassert a state government comparable to the vitality of our private sector.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker is Dr. Kevin Starr, California State Librarian Emeritus and Professor of History at the University of Southern California, who is discussing California's critical post-World War II period and how it helped shape the nation. There are a couple of questions about immigration. You note in your book California's ambivalence about immigrant labor. That issue remains with us today. How do you see a successful and humane resolution to that challenge?
Well, Father, let me refine a little bit your statement. The ambivalence to a certain kind of immigrant labor was the ambivalence to illegal immigrant labor, the so-called, I even don't like to say the word, it's such derogatory, but the so-called wetback phenomenon of illegal immigrants. And this was led by Cesar Chavez and the Mexican-Americans trying to organize a union. And it was also led by people in the Bracero program who were here legally as guest workers, who could come up to California and earn $1,000 in a season of picking, go home, take care of their village, get their home fixed up, to get wonderful benefits, et cetera. So, and then we experimented, not we, but the whole nation experimented, about 57, 58, Operation Wetback, of a big roundup of illegal immigrants, and it was, I think, catastrophic, didn't work. So the objections to illegals came from the Mexican-American unionists and Filipino-American unionists who were trying to organize unions, and it also came, to repeat myself, from legitimate Bracero workers. Today we have a much different problem. I don't really think that the problem of the 50s is the same as today as having this huge... The wetback phenomenon was not huge like the populations that we have now. And so we're not going to have roundups. Now, this is just my opinion. Who am I? I'm not an elected official. But obviously some kind of, if we have politics, Republicans and Democrats and independents will hammer out some solution to this issue at the federal level. We have to be very careful in discussing it, et cetera, that we don't lump in any immigrant group, et cetera. All of us, my great-grandfather came to San Francisco in 1852. I don't think he had any papers. I just think he bought a ticket and got off the bus. He got off the boat. He came with his sister. Somebody was telling me, asking me, well, who was the most respected Californian? And I said, well, probably statistically or through surveys, John Muir. And somebody said, well, he was an illegal immigrant. He just came here from Scotland. He didn't. We took in 36 million people in the 19th century. We sent a number of them back. If you see the movie Godfather 2, I think, or Ellis Island, where they would send back the people who had disease, et cetera. Very, very poignant, very sad. We just have to hammer out this solution in a fair and equitable way that doesn't insult any immigrant group who's here now, because we're all immigrant groups. Even Native Americans, ultimately, are an immigrant group from Asia.
You mentioned that this book covers basically for you were 10 to 23. Did you find it more difficult to write a history of a period that you actually lived through than not? And then in writing this history, did this in any way shape or refashion your opinions on current issues?
Well, the fact I was writing about a period that I knew led me to lose it once completely. Critics are saying, and all the things you had to talk about, you got a whole chapter on Dave Brubeck? And then I just thought, wow, I just love Brubeck so much. I just got out of control when I wrote that chapter. I couldn't stop. So, no, it's highly selective. Incidentally, I stayed away from the abstract art scene in California during this period because my wife and I were at the Paris 2-3 years ago, went to the Pompidou Center, and there was a beautiful show on California abstract art from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And I said to myself, I respect this, but I'll have to study it a little further to be able to say anything intelligent about it. Now, in earlier times, I had no trouble talking about Impressionists or even the figurative painting of the Bay Area. Diebenkorn, for instance, I understand Diebenkorn. I understand Wayne Thiebaud. I understand any number of work. Some of it, to relate that to social phenomena. Although the minute I say that, I have a sequence on Richard Serra, the great sculptor whose work is in the Bilbao Frank Gehry building, et cetera, who's from Oakland here, from the East Bay. I found it full of temptations to – I wanted to talk – one of the things I wanted to go against was to this cliche of young women being, you know, suppressed. You see it in the movies, et cetera. Not, in terms of when I was growing up, the young women were all going to great – in high school and college. They were all going to great colleges. They all had – at least, and I was not from privileged background. They were as ambitious as the men. So I had to suppress the temptation to call people up and see how life had gone for them, et cetera. You can't go back. You know, my wife just went to her 50th high school reunion class, Mercy Burlingame, and it was quite an emotional experience to go back and recover that amount of time, et cetera. So I had to put a little certain distance there. This wasn't about me. I've never used the word I in any of my books except in an acknowledgement. And I'm not devoid of a proper amount of ego. But these books are not about me that way.
The second part of that question, Kevin, in the writing of the book, did this in any way influence your judgment or change your judgment on contemporary political, social, economic, cultural issues?
It made me realize that flexible politics that meet at the center are needed more than ever. How did we create this infrastructure? We created it through, ultimately, the people we sent up to Sacramento authorized it. In late night sessions with cigars, I don't know, but they authorized it. And the civil servants with their double breath, all the pens in their pockets, et cetera, design those freeways, et cetera, and the elected officials authorize it. I think that's state politics. We have to get back to that again. Now, I'm repeating myself now, but I will. Doesn't mean that everybody gets everything he or she wants, but nobody is left totally devoid, totally disrespected, totally suppressed.
The headline in this morning's San Francisco Chronicle read, East Bay, San Francisco fear rationing in the future. So the article opined that the North's water would be drained to supply the South, and that this would undermine water rights that are more than 100 years old. Does the history of this issue shed any light on the present challenges?
Yes, that it's a fear. It's a fear in the Northern California mind that every effort you make to talk somebody off the scaffolding, they won't come off. It is really a paranoid fear. A paranoid fear. And please, even though it was difficult, read my chapter on the water, because you'll see how the North and South had to negotiate this. The Bay Area was against the California water plan because of this fear. The Bay Area was against the peripheral canal, obviously, because of this fear that all the water was going to go down there. You have a series of acts. You have an origin of water acts, et cetera, that will make sure that could never happen. In fact, Placer County, a couple of years ago, thanks to legislation put through federally by Senator Bradley and Senator Pete Wilson at the time, had so much water that they sold it down to Southern California. Sold it. They made a nice profit. So I really don't think so. There's one California, and the laws are the legal system protecting water rights, et cetera, are very established. But it's inflammatory to say, what, Southern Californians are going to rise up and turn us into a desert? I just don't. Of course, I teach at USC. So take that in consideration as you hear my opinion.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our speaker is Dr. Kevin Starr, California State Librarian Emeritus and Professor of History at the University of Southern California, who is discussing California's critical post-World War II period and how it helped shape the nation. This question here about how do you account for so much current-ish interest in the 60s?
Well, I think the boomer generation is now moving into its golden years. And this is, we have 40 plus years now to see the tremendous effect that generation and that shift of values and points of view. I don't really think I'm hostile to that. The fact that I don't understand it completely doesn't mean I'm hostile to it. That shift of values and point of view, et cetera, has had this extraordinary effect on our culture. So there's an enormous. Oxford University Press just published a book, just to reinforce your saying, on a history of the 60s. A number of new books on the politics of the 60s coming out now. But I think my contribution is, in terms of the 60s, is how things changed very once we went into the tippy-toed into the 60s, 1, 2, 3, 4, and how dramatically the world changed. America changed. Values changed. And it has to be – a lot of this is done is from the point of view of child rearing. Child rearing. Silent generation, my age group, I'm 69, we were told, do what the adults tell you, behave yourself, and they'll take care of you. And the boomers were not raised that way. They were raised in a much different Dr. Spock influence. So child rearing practices changed, et cetera. And I have two daughters and seven grandchildren. It's very interesting to see sequences of child rearing practices, et cetera, how that shifts. I'm not defending one or the other, but it does have relationship to how that generation will behave or will conduct itself in general during the period. I remember going to a lot of looking at some 50-year, you'll see them cited here, 50-year reminiscences from high schools during this period. And the 70s were a tough decade on people. A lot of people confessed to the 70s being difficult for them economically, difficult for their marriages. Many marriages ended during that decade, et cetera, from 50, silent generation people moving in this new world and not fully prepared, maybe, I don't know. I remain oblivious to it all. I met my wife. She was 17, 18. She went to Lone Mountain, and then she went to Berkeley. And we got married in the Army in 1963 in Coleman Kasern in Germany. But that's the luck of the draw. I don't know, maybe she's had a lot of thoughts, but she's never told me about them.
There's a question about California's public education system. It used to be the pride of the state and now has degenerated dramatically. Do you see any hope of the system's improving?
Well, first of all, I understand where the question is coming from, but let me make a defense before I give an equivocal answer. Has there ever been a public education system that has been asked to take the people of the world in a short period of time and to help them make the transition into American citizenship? If you look at Jacob Riis's book, The Other Half, Jacob Riis, a Danish-American writer, photographer, he has some wonderful pictures in the 1890s of school teachers, young women school teachers in classes in New York, and they're there in their beautiful white blouses and with their hair in the Gibson style, et cetera, and there's absolute class of Italian immigrants and Eastern European Jewish immigrants, and these school teachers were bringing those kids into American life. And within a generation, you take Eastern European Jewish immigration into this country in the 80s and 90s, within a generation, these people are the judges, lawyers, doctors, symphony orchestra conductors, et cetera. We Californians were asked to do something comparable, except for the world. The world, there's something like 80 languages at one point that were documented in the Los Angeles School District. So I think that that's something that should be out there, should condition, although I'm not disputing the fact that we didn't, that we've had a lot of problems with our school, with our public, just education system that probably resides in shifts of attitudes for discipline, homework, supervision, parents going to school along with their children, paying attention, et cetera. But as long as we do that, I'm very suspicious at any time of beating up on teachers who have helped us to take a universal population and move them along the pathway to American identity, American citizenship.
What do you think it will take to reverse the trend of more people leaving California than coming to California, or should we want to even reverse that trend?
Well, you know, there's an article in the New York Daily News I read a couple years ago. A woman and her husband were in San Diego. Then the economy collapsed in the early 90s, and they moved up to Idaho. And then a couple years later, they came back, which time they were interviewed in the Los Angeles Daily News. And they bought a home, not the same home, but they bought a home on the similar block in San Diego. But this time the California economy had recovered. They were paying an enormous amount of money compared to what they first with their home. And then they asked the reporter asked the woman, "Well, why'd you leave Idaho?" And she said, "Well," she said, "you can't get good takeout in Idaho." So I said to myself, here I spent 40 years ruining my eyesight, reading through these dusty tomes, taking notes, writing all these volumes, trying to say what she said like that. In any event, I'm suggesting that California doesn't need to be huge, although our population will be large. We will have 50 million people by 2040. Just live births will handle that, et cetera. I think we have to get our statewide reputation together. Our statewide culture together, and the reputation will follow. But I don't see any particular outpouring of Californians. That's why it's very crucial that we look at this education, higher education. I don't like the trend of closing community colleges, knocking the classes down, and cutting back the University of California, the California State University, et cetera. Particularly think that that's a real cutting edge where the failure of statewide politics shows itself. That could drive away a lot of young people, embitter them at a crucial point in their life.
Our thanks to Dr. Kevin Starr, California State Librarian Emeritus, Professor of History at the University of Southern California, and author of Golden Dreams, California in an Age of Abundance, 1950 to 1963. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Father Stephen Prevett, and now this Lafayette meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.